Welcome to the Portugal Street Philosophy Podcast, where each episode we take a deep dive into a philosophical topic in conversation with world-leading experts. I'm your host, Eric Chen. And joining me today as co-host is the president of the Philosophy Society, Karina Vassiliadis. Thanks for joining us, Karina.
Thank you, Eric. It's great to be here.
This episode, our topic is animal sentience, and our guide to the topic is Professor Jonathan Birch. Professor Birch is an associate professor of philosophy at the London School of Economics and principal investigator on the Foundations of Animal Sentience project, which was awarded a prestigious European Research Council starting grant, the value of 1.5 million euros. In addition to his interest in animal sentience, cognition, and welfare, he also has a long-standing interest in the evolution of altruism and social behavior. His first book, The Philosophy of Social Evolution, was published by Oxford University Press in 2017. Thanks so much for joining us, Professor Jonathan Birch.
That's no problem. Thanks for inviting me.
Great. So I wanted to start the discussion on your project that you're heading, Foundations of Animal Sentience. Could you just give us a brief overview of the project and what its central aims are?
Well, the goal of the project is to construct solid conceptual and methodological foundations for a science of animal sentience. Sentience is the capacity to feel. It comes from the Latin for to feel. And it's the capacity to have feelings, feelings like joy, pleasure, pain, hunger, thirst, warmth, anxiety, all of these things that are familiar to us as feelings. And we wonder whether other animals share these things with us or whether some of them might be uniquely human. But then it's a controversial topic in science because many scientists have traditionally said we can't study the subjective side of animal minds scientifically. We can study the functional side. We can study what's going on in the brain of an animal when it does something. We can study what neurons are being activated, what brain regions are being lit up. But we can't study the subjective side. We can't understand how it feels from the animal's point of view. And so the project really is about trying to meet that challenge and construct the foundations for a science that can tell us something about which animals feel and hopefully what they feel. And really, I think that's one of the great challenges for science and philosophy in the 21st century. And the project is about trying to tackle it.
Right. So you mentioned sentience is the capacity to feel broadly. I just want to dwell on this concept for a moment and maybe try to disentangle it from a few other things that are notoriously difficult in philosophy that might be related. So could you maybe say a bit about how this concept relates to the idea of phenomenal consciousness or subjective experience, qualia, on the one hand, and also the maybe relatedly, how does it relate to the concept of moral status or moral patienthood?
Great questions. Well, let's take them in turn. I much prefer the concept sentience to the concept phenomenal consciousness, but I realize that people talk about phenomenal consciousness a lot. I prefer feeling as well. I think feeling, we all intuitively grasp and we all understand. Phenomenal consciousness starts to sound like a technical term. But really, if you ask philosophers to define phenomenal consciousness, what they do is refer you back to a list of examples. They say, imagine the experience of looking at a red sky or smelling coffee. Just imagine having that conscious experience. There's something it's like. And so phenomenal consciousness is this technical sounding way of introducing the idea that there's something it's like to be in that state. There's some fact of the matter about what it's like from the animal's point of view. And so definitely sentience involves the capacity to form states with that elusive property, the capacity to form states that feel like something, that there's something it's like to be in. I think usually when the term is used in discussions of animal ethics and animal welfare, there's a little bit more to it than just that. So sentience is the capacity to form phenomenally conscious states, to have conscious experiences, but not just any such states, specifically states that feel good or feel bad, that have a positive or negative quality, positive or negative valence. And those two things, you know, there's something it feels like and it feels good or it feels bad. That's what's captured in my list of examples at the beginning there, you know, joy, anxiety, boredom, hunger, thirst, warmth, all of those things. There's something it feels like and it's not neutral. It's either bad, feels bad or feels good. So you can think of sentience as capacity to form valenced phenomenally conscious states, if you want to put it in philosophical jargon. And then your second question there was about moral status, which is another great question. Moral status, we say something has moral status, it's another term of art in philosophy. We say that when something has interests that matter morally for their own sake or in their own right. And that's a subtle idea that you might think even something like a vase on a shelf matters morally in a sense because the owner will be very upset if you break it. But that doesn't mean the vase has moral status. It only matters because of how someone else feels about it. And so moral status is supposed to capture this idea that it has interests that matter morally in their own right, regardless of what anyone else feels. You know, and then we think about animals and ask, do they have moral status? They certainly matter to us. Now, if you go and kill someone's dog, they'll be very unhappy about it. But we're asking, does the dog have interests that matter morally in its own right? And that's where sentience comes in, because it is very closely related, I think, to moral status. And what I would say is that it is at least a sufficient condition. Just to say, if something is sentient, if you can show, for example, that the crab is sentient or that an octopus is sentient, this shows that it has moral status. Because if you're sentient, you're having these valenced experiences, these experiences that feel good or feel bad. And on the face of it, that grounds facts about interests. You have an interest in escaping experiences that are very aversive and unpleasant. And you have an interest in having more of experiences that are pleasant and rewarding. So sentient animals have interests. I'm a lot less sure that sentience is necessary for moral status. And so I try to avoid claiming that. What I think is that it's sufficient.
Okay, great. That's extremely clear and helpful. I wanted to clarify another sort of related philosophical issue before we dive into the details of the project. You mentioned that the project is about trying to make empirical progress on ascertaining sentience in animals. But I was wondering what your view is on the relationship between this kind of research and commitments to metaphysical theories of consciousness, and whether the project makes any sort of these substantive commitments, or does the project leave these issues as somewhat of an open question?
That's another great question. You sound like a reviewer on the grant proposal with these questions. What I'm trying to do here is put a research program together that is as neutral as possible on those metaphysical questions. So I don't want to commit to a materialist view of consciousness, for example. I don't want to commit to a dualist view either. Don't want to commit to a panpsychist view. And I don't want to rule out any of those possibilities either, because I don't think we can rule them out. Not scientifically. We can have our own views based on philosophical arguments, but really all of those options are on the table. And so what I want to do is find ways of studying animal consciousness that don't require us to have first solved the mind-body problem and to first have an agreed theory of consciousness. Because I think if we sat around waiting for that, we'd be waiting forever. And we actually need a science of animal sentience now, I think, to try and design better animal welfare policies and laws.
Okay, great. That makes sense. So I guess I want to talk about a particular research paper that was listed under this project that you co-authored on dimensions of animal consciousness. Mm. Could you just give us a quick summary of the state of the debate within the field of animal consciousness and how the sides have in this field perhaps have changed over the last few decades?
The sides. I'm not sure what to say about the sides. There are definitely
maybe that's too.
There are skeptics who think we cannot study animal consciousness scientifically. And there's certain flashpoints in the controversy where people debate whether certain types of animal are sentient at all. So I mentioned octopuses and crabs. Invertebrates in general are great sources of debate. Even if you feel pretty sure that a crab is sentient, you might start to wonder about a snail or about a jellyfish or about a sponge. Everyone has their stopping point where they think, hang on, is that actually sentient? And then you get controversy about how to settle that kind of dispute. And in fact, you even get disputes about fish as well, where I think majority opinion would be all right ascribing sentience to fish, but you get very vocal critics who want to argue that there's no evidence of that whatsoever and that it's completely wrong to be designing animal welfare laws to protect fish when we don't have that kind of evidence.
Right. And is there a sort of consensus view within the field at the moment about which that we're comfortable saying are sentient or and, you know, where we will most draw the line?
Consensus might be a bit too strong a word. There was a statement in 2012 called the Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness, which was an attempt to build a consensus. And it was an attempt to build a consensus around the idea that mammals and birds, at least, have conscious experiences. And it also mentions octopuses and says, yeah, probably octopuses as well, which is really interesting because you might think they'd mention other vertebrates before octopuses, but that it, mammals, birds, and octopuses are mentioned in this statement. And so that's the closest there is to a consensus. I think with mammals, the view is very much in favor of sentience because we can see the same brain regions and the same neural mechanisms. And they have that crinkly structure around the outer of the brain called the neocortex, the outer 2 millimeters or so of the brain that is linked quite strongly to conscious experience in us. That's there in other mammals. And so really there is approaching a consensus there. With birds, a bit less of a consensus. With fish, a bit less still. With invertebrates, it gets even more controversial.
Can we just go into a bit more detail about these kind of controversial animals or species, particularly with octopuses and crabs and fish? Just because in some cases, like I think Peter Godfrey Smith made quite a strong case for the kind of unassumed similarities between humans and cephalopods. So could you go into a bit more detail about why there is this controversy, despite there being some evolutionary evidence for the similarities?
Well, octopuses have followed a completely different evolutionary path from us. There's more than 500 million years of evolutionary history separating us from our last common ancestor with an octopus. And the nervous system is very differently organized. It's quite a bit more delocalized, so that there's a lot of the nerves in the arms and in a ring of ganglia around the top of the arms. And the structure of the brain is just very different. So in all vertebrates, you get basic anatomical features in the brain that reappear. And you can find a forebrain and a midbrain and a hind brain. And then you look at invertebrates and it's just totally different. It's evolved completely separately. So if they've evolved conscious experience, it's a case of so-called convergent evolution. It's the same outcome via a radically different route. And so that's the source of the skepticism that people say, well, I'll grant you convergent evolution sometimes happens with eyes and things like that, because no one can really debate whether octopuses have eyes. They just do. But when it comes to conscious experience, you know, the skeptic then says, well, you can't really show they have it in the first place. And so why should I believe your claim that it's a case of convergent evolution?
So given these very prominent differences, how then are we to kind of pinpoint what it is for these contentious species to have sentience? And how can we establish this given these radical differences?
Yeah, well, the first question, what is it for them to have sentience? I think we're not going to be able to do any better than just give our list of examples and say for them to be sentient would be for them to have feelings that are in some way like pain, pleasure, joy, anxiety. They don't have to have the precise kinds of feeling that we have, but for them to be sentient would for them to be to have conscious experiences with positive or negative valence, states that there's something it feels like to be in, feels good or feels bad. So we can at least get a grip on what we're debating, but then the real question is what could possibly constitute evidence of that, really. And then, you know, that's where it gets controversial. And in the end, one way or another, I think you have to rely on evidence from behavior and evidence from cognition. And then, yeah, the question is how you move from evidence from behavior and cognition to inferences about conscious experience. And we're still at an early stage in understanding how to do that.
Right. So on the question of how consciousness sort of varies within the animal kingdom and whether species are more conscious than others. So in this paper, you set up maybe this intuitive view where we see it as on a single line and we see humans as like near one end, it was really, really conscious. And then as we move to lower animals, we see the degree of consciousness sort of diminish until we end up at some like really simple things that we might be confident are not conscious. But you instead argue for a multidimensional framework for thinking about how consciousness varies. Could you a bit about why this intuitive picture might be misleading or incorrect in your view?
It's misleading because it will inevitably leave out lots of important dimensions of variation that don't line up perfectly with each other. And you can make that point purely in the human case, really. And Tim Bain and colleagues have made it in the human case, that doctors often, when they're treating patients in a minimally conscious state, will try to grade them on how conscious they are and give them a level of consciousness. And Tim Bain and colleagues have argued, well, that's just, it's not the most useful way to approach these cases, because actually there's multiple different cross-cutting dimensions of variation along which a conscious state can vary. And we need a framework for understanding that multidimensional variation, rather than just saying that one patient is more conscious or less conscious than another. And so in this paper on dimensions of animal consciousness with Alex Schnell and Nikki Clayton, we argue that the same applies to animals, and that it's a bad starting point to think, let's try and rank animals on how conscious they are, and let's see if mammals are more conscious than birds, for example. Instead, we need to be finding somewhat more fine-grained dimensions of variation than that, that we can actually get some grip on how they might vary, and then try and construct a consciousness profile for a different type of animal that tries to find where it is along these different dimensions, rather than just putting it along one single dimension.
Right, okay, that makes sense. And then you list these five key dimensions of variation, which I'll just quickly go through now. There are perceptual richness, evaluative richness, integration at a single time and across time, and self-consciousness. I was wondering if you could explain the second one, evaluative richness. How do you conceptualize this? And could you give some examples of experiments where they try to evaluate evaluative richness within an organism?
Yeah, well, it gets to this idea of valence that I introduced before, of something feeling good and feeling bad. And it's a proposal for how we can think about variation in that, where, you know, some animals like us, we have rich evaluative experiences, in that virtually everything that, you know, every experience we have has some positive or negative valence. And we can be sensitive to very small differences. You can have a preference, for example, between two coffee cups, and you can feel better when you're holding your favorite cup than when you're holding a disfavored cup. So we make these very fine-grained evaluative judgments, and our evaluative experiences are very rich. And then we can test for that kind of thing in non-human animals, presuming them to be conscious. So we're thinking here about animals where we think they do have some experiences of some kind. As I've said, mammals and birds are probably the clearest cases. Once you think it's okay to assume that, you can then ask, well, how rich is the evaluative character of the animal's experiences? And you can probe that with questions about how sensitive it is to trade-offs between different variables. And there's an experiment I particularly like that was by Kabanak et al. in the 90s on rats, where they asked, will the rat trade off the sweetness of a reward it can get by going through a cold tube against the coldness that it has to endure while it's going through it? Will there be this trade-off curve where if there's a slightly sweeter reward on offer, it will tolerate a somewhat colder tube, but then for a slightly less sweet reward, it's no longer worth it? If you can show that, as they did in this experiment, seems to me very good evidence that there's this weighing process going on in the rat, that it's weighing up the opportunity for reward against how bad the suffering is that has to be endured to get that reward. And so you've got both of these things represented, and represented in a common currency that allows a flexible decision. So it's weighing up the sweetness of the sugar solution against the coldness of the, you know, the disvalue of the cold tube. And that kind of experiment gives us some evidence, I think, that the cold tube is associated with an aversive experience in the rat. And moreover, you can say something about how bad that experience is relative to how good the experience of the sweetness is. So that's the sort of experiment I think there should be more of in order to try and probe the evaluative experiences of animals.
Well, that's extremely interesting. So, but is there, maybe this is too early in the days of these experiments, but are there proposals for how you would sort of normalize these sort of measurements of evaluative like sensitivity across different species? For instance, like if you did this to humans and you found that they were like super sensitive to tiny changes in the how pleasurable is, and then you find some other sensitivity in rat, like would there be a meaningful sense in which you could say humans are like more evaluatively rich in their experience using these experiments?
Well, I think we're sort of at the stage at the moment of making quite coarse-grained, quite qualitative comparisons. We don't even have that much evidence on which to make those. But for example, you might find out that there's some, it's hard to get rats to trade off more than three different variables against each other or something like that. There's no evidence for that, but suppose you found it out. And then you did similar experiments on humans and you found that humans could quite easily trade off four, five, six, seven, many more different things. That would be some evidence for the humans having richer evaluative experiences in which more things are being valued in this common currency. But that work hasn't been done.
Okay, that makes sense. And so we have these five dimensions. But would it make sense to, could we sort of pick out one of these and then rank, would it then make more sense compared to stipulating like a single line? If we have these five dimensions and we pick a single one, and then we were to rank all the species on this line, would this sort of make more sense? And do they tend to just be correlated with each other anyway, so it ends up resembling?
Well, we don't take any view on whether they're correlated with each other. But the whole point of having a multidimensional framework is that we shouldn't expect them to be very well correlated. And so there will be something informative about knowing the shape of the profile. And then the hope is that we find dimensions on along which some sort of ordering of animals is realistic. So there's still significant challenges, but the thought is that if you're comparing them specifically on evaluative richness, say, or if you're comparing animals specifically on integration at a time or across time, it may be possible at least to make comparisons about which animals perform better on that type of task than others, and that's at least more feasible than trying to rank them on a single scale.
Right. I guess I was just curious if you had any salient examples where there was like a surprising animal that in terms of the metrics that it scored on. I guess the intuition might be that humans are at the peak in terms of the animal kingdom, in terms of all these dimensions, and also that they would be positively correlated. But I was wondering if you had any examples of maybe an animal where there's like some evidence to suggest they outperform humans in one of these, or maybe one where they perform really highly on all four.
Well, in the perceptual categories, I think animals will quite often outperform humans with respect to specific sense modalities. So for vision, we'd be beaten by a lot of species, birds of prey, for example, and then for olfaction, again, beaten by a lot of species, dogs, pigs, elephants. I'm less sure about the others. Things like selfhood, I think humans do access a grade of selfhood that is probably higher than those achieved by other animals.
Right. Okay. I guess the perceptual richness, that point makes sense. Are there any other examples of an animal sort of like scoring really highly on the majority of the metrics, but just surprisingly low on one of the other ones, or does that not tend to occur?
Well, we're not really at the stage of scoring animals in any kind of precise way. What the paper proposes is the general framework and the general idea of attempting that, rather than actually doing it.
Right, okay.
Maybe over the longer term, we'd find surprising dissociations. Maybe octopuses, for example, would turn out to score very highly in lots of ways and then be surprisingly disunified because of the way in which the nervous system is distributed between the brain and the arms.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. This is still like really early days of making progress on this.
Yeah, a lot of those judgments about where we put animals along the particular dimensions are quite speculative.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. Are there any sort of experiments in light of this that you're really excited about over the next few years that you think will be particularly clarifying on some of these?
What are we doing over the next few years? It's a good question. What we're trying to do right now in the project focuses on bees. So we're working with bee labs in London at Queen Mary and Royal Holloway. And we think bees are a really great case where there's genuine debate about whether they're sentient or not at all. But there's plausible arguments both ways. Critics can point to the fact that the brain only has about 1 million neurons compared to 100 billion or so in our own case. And then others can point to the very impressive learning abilities of bees. And so we're trying to design experiments that might have the potential to dissociate conscious and unconscious perception in bees in order to show that there are these two streams, as seems to be the case in us, that sometimes we perceive things unconsciously, but sometimes we perceive them consciously. And we're trying to find ways of showing that in bees. So part of it is about looking for kinds of learning that we think have reason to believe are linked to conscious experience, to the conscious perceptual stream. And in particular, learning across temporal gaps is particularly interesting, so-called trace conditioning, where you learn an association between two stimuli. So you might learn that a flash of light or a tone is followed a second later by a puff of air in your eye. And of course, we can learn that temporal relation and learn to blink at the right moment. But it seems that the ability to do that, to learn the 1 second time interval, is closely related to conscious experience of the stimuli, so that if they were presented subliminally, you'd no longer be able to do that. So we're thinking, can we reproduce that kind of dissociation in bees? Can we show that there are some things they can't do when the stimuli are presented subliminally to them, that they can do when they're presented supraliminally to them?
Right. Okay. That's extremely interesting. I'm like really excited about the findings of this project, but I want to move on a bit to maybe like the meta level and talk about particular ethical approaches that we might take to animal sentience. In particular, one of your papers on animal sentience and the precautionary principle. I thought it would be worth discussing a bit on this. Just give sort of the statement of the precautionary principle and what you think the primary arguments in favor of taking this seriously.
This is all about what we should do now when we're faced with the question of how to set the scope of animal welfare law when there are all these debates about sentience in invertebrates and fish and so on. And the proposal is we should borrow this precautionary principle idea from environmental policy, that where there are very serious threats to animal welfare, the absence of scientific certainty or consensus on the question of sentience shouldn't be used as a reason for delaying taking proportionate precautions to try and prevent those very bad animal welfare outcome.
So what is the sort of primary argument? Is this,
we should err on the side of caution, I suppose, is the one line version. Give the animals the benefit of the doubt.
So is this just sort of by applying expected value reasoning, where you think on the chance that they're not sentient, it's not that important, but in the case that they are sentient, it would just be this terrible harm? So is this like a separate principle, or can we just basically arrive at the same conclusion by just doing a sort of expected value reasoning over the, you know, the possible states of sentience?
Yeah, it depends a bit what you mean by expected value reasoning, I think. I mean, one of the attractions of precautionary reasoning in any context, including public health and, you know, pandemics and climate change, etc., is this thought that sometimes cost-benefit analysis is not the best way to formulate policy. and that in particular, there's a danger of cost-benefit analysis leading us into trouble in cases where things are so severely uncertain that we can't really assign precise probabilities to them. And also in cases where the values of the costs and the benefits present us with problems of incommensurability. They're just incredibly difficult to compare. And I think the case of animal welfare does have those features in that if you're asking, well, how much expense to fishermen measured in pounds should we be willing to incur to protect the welfare of to protect a fish from intense pain at the point of death? There's real problems of incommensurability there that mean you'd never really get agreement on how to make that kind of weighing. And equally, putting probabilities on things like what's the probability of a fish being sentient, you never really get agreement on that either. And so precautionary framework, I think, becomes distinctively attractive in cases where we have reason to believe that problems of assigning probabilities and values to outcomes have the potential to paralyze the policy-making process and prevent us from taking precautions that we would really regret not taking. And so that's the kind of argument that motivates precautionary reasoning in general, including in this case.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. But what do you think is the strongest sort of counter-argument against taking this precautionary approach? And what is like the sort of default view that we should, sort of like if we reject this kind of precautionary approach, what would other
counter-argument? I mean, in practice, the counter-argument is that any extension of animal welfare law of any kind has costs to humans, and that those costs to humans can be very large. Now, often I think those costs can be mitigated. For example, if you're imposing stronger welfare requirements on the fishing industry, for example, there's ways to compensate the industry. There's ways to counterbalance that. They can always put higher welfare branding on the products at the end of the day, making them more attractive to consumers. And so there's all these things you can do to offset the costs. But in the end, people will argue there are still costs. And then the second part of the counter argument would be that those costs to humans deserve special weight in moral reasoning that greatly exceeds the weight that should be put on the suffering experienced by a fish, for example. And it really would have, the weight really would have to greatly exceed, I think, but some people are happy with that.
So I wanted to ask now, with the current kind of state of animal welfare and our approaches to it, and given the kind of both the precautionary approach and the kind of project of animal sentience, what do you think the kind of future moral approach to animals will take, given the research that's being done on sentience and that as related to their moral status? How will this shift from perhaps how we currently view animals to how we might view animals?
You mean, will there be a shift at all? Is that the question?
If there will be, yes. So if there will be a shift, what do you think this shift will look like?
Are you asking for a utopian vision, I suppose? I mean, I guess the utopian vision, well, would just be one in which there's a very large-scale reorienting of the way we think about animals, sort of moving away from seeing them as a resource to be exploited and thinking of them instead as creatures with which we share the world and that are a source of great joy and pleasure for us and that we should be respecting as much as we possibly can. Now, I don't think that utopian situation is all that realistic, but that's in a way, that's the goal.
Unfortunately, we are currently not living in utopia. So I guess
no.
I wanted to discuss your thoughts on whether, so in light of all the research on animal sentience, consciousness, and in terms of ethical approaches to thinking about welfare, do you think there are any clear policy implications that we can be pretty confident are correct for now, given in light of all the evidence that is currently not being implemented? Like, are there any particular animal welfare practices that you think are just clearly bad?
Yeah, there are. I'm working at the moment on a project for DEFRA that is about producing a report into evidence of sentience in decapod crustaceans, which means crabs, lobsters, and crayfish, and cephalopod mollusks, which means octopuses, squid, and cuttlefish. And so that report, I think, is due to come out in December, and that report will contain various recommendations about how we think UK animal welfare law should change. And in a way, this is a good moment for improving animal welfare law, because the UK is exiting the EU and is not constrained by EU regulations and directives. And in principle, it presents an opportunity that I think the government wants to take to make animal welfare law the strongest in the world. And so you can wait for that report to see our recommendations on that issue. Now, that's about invertebrates. I also think for fish, I would like to see stronger welfare protection than exists now. The Animal Welfare Act at the moment in the UK, it gives and it takes away, because the scope includes all vertebrates, including fish, which you think, wow, that's very forward thinking, isn't it? But then there's a clause later on that says nothing in this act should be taken to apply to anything that occurs in the normal course of fishing. So the protection there is for fish outside the context of fishing.
And like I think all three of them.
I think it might be time to think about how we might design better animal welfare law for fishing.
Right. Okay. Are there particular pieces of legislation that people should be aware of or should be supporting, or are there any sort of immediate?
Well, not yet. No, we're trying to. There'll be this report, and then I think there'll be some new legislation next year that hopefully people will support.
Right. And are there particular sort of, if people are interested in sort of having institutional change on these issues, are there particular paths that you might want to highlight for them to look into, as in like promising or interested graduates and undergraduates?
It's a good question. I'm always happy to hear from interested students interested in these issues. I'm really impressed in general with the work of animal welfare organizations on these issues. I think I can say that without prejudging what's in our report. The RSPCA does a lot of work on sentience that I think is really excellent. There's an organization called Crustacean Compassion that has been very enthusiastically campaigning for improved welfare protection for decapod crustaceans, and a charity called World Animal Protection as well that has been active on these issues. And to me, they're demonstrating there the right way to go about influencing policy and producing change, with very respectful but persistent campaigning on issues that the public actually cares about, and that they can show ministers very clearly that the public does care about.
Right. Okay, that sounds promising. But there's also a dimension of sort of personal takeaways from all this research. Do you think there are kind of clear implications for, well, I mean, I guess the most obvious one is like dietary choices for people. Do you think it's like,
yeah, should everyone be vegetarians or vegan?
Or vegans? Like, yeah, I guess that's the question. Is it pretty clear in light of all we know that veganism or vegetarianism is like the right choice, or is there like, or is it within a reasonable margin of error?
It's a tough question, because a lot of people in the animal ethics world want to say that vegetarianism or veganism are morally obligatory. And I don't really say that. It's just not really my style to say things like that, I think. What I think is that vegetarianism and veganism are virtue signaling in a good way. But people give such a bad press to virtue signaling at the moment. I don't understand it, because it seems to me that if something is virtuous, there's no reason not to express that virtue. And this is how it is with vegetarianism and veganism, that in a way, everyone who's a vegetarian is saying in quite a public way, I support this general movement to try and reduce our reliance on meat and on intensive farming. And in a way, whenever you sit down with anyone and have lunch or dinner, you're posing that question to them. Do you also support this movement or not? Do we have a quorum here? Do we have enough people to make this happen or not? And I think it's great that it's great to have vegetarians and vegans who are sending that signal and posing that question. That's why I think it's a good idea.
But you don't think there's any sort of moral...
But I don't really think it's morally obligatory. I think sometimes when people say it's morally obligatory, they are over-moralizing something that is actually not directly perpetrating animal cruelty, but rather is eating.
Right, but I guess... Just to press on this issue a bit more, do you think that maybe not in terms of like the deontic side, but like axiologically, do you think going vegan or vegetarian is like pretty clearly the better choice?
Yeah, I think that's implied by what I just said. Yeah, that I think it's virtuous and that it is good to do things that are contributing towards movements directed at positive change. Absolutely.
Yeah, fantastic. I guess with that, we're going to, there's a lot more to cover, but we want to move on to some audience questions, also our signature questions that I hope you will enjoy.
Good.
Thank you so much for this very informative discussion. So we have some signature questions, which are customary to all of our guests on the podcast. And so these are kind of lighthearted questions just to ask you a bit about your personal philosophical beliefs and find out a bit more. So the first question we have is, if you could ask any question to a super intelligent oracle, what question would you ask them?
Probably, what are the necessary and sufficient conditions for sentience that are such that they are easily empirically measurable?
Thank you.
The project would then be a waste of time, but it would be worth it, I think.
They can't take back the funding, right? So I guess it's a bit of a win-win.
Yeah, we just have to find something else to spend it on.
Thank you. So the next question is, which philosopher would you most like to have a conversation with, if it could be any philosopher?
Socrates.
How come?
Is that a really boring answer?
Not at all. We're just curious.
Well, he's both the cleverest person in the history of philosophy and the most enigmatic, because we have no idea what he really thinks about things. I'd love to ask what he really thinks about things. And you know, all of that, you know, anti-democracy, reactionary stuff, is that just all Plato, really?
Thank you. It's a very interesting one. So, and then our final question is, what is your most controversial philosophical belief that you hold?
My most controversial philosophical belief? That's a very dangerous question to throw in there. It's a supposedly lighthearted question.
It doesn't have to be political. You can go with, like, the external world. That's also part of...
I do believe there's an external world, so I don't have controversial views on most things. So try to think of something of about the right level of controversy. And I think that interactionist dualism should be taken seriously as a possible solution to the mind-body problem. I said that in a blog post quite recently, so it's not totally new to this podcast, but I think that that's a controversial view, but not politically controversial.
Okay, great. That's just the right level of controversial we're going for.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for joining us on this podcast. So we're going to now open it up to some questions from the floor. So the first question that we have, if someone is considering changing their diet on the margin and we want to give up eating either chicken or beef, how should they make this decision with regard to suffering?
Oh, that's getting me back into the territory of making dietary recommendations that I was deliberately trying to get away from. My sense is that chicken farming produces a larger amount of suffering. If you think about it, there's far more animals being generated. You're eating a larger fraction of the animal each time. And the conditions in which chickens are intensively farmed are extremely troubling. There's such huge numbers per square meter that they often end up with chronic leg pain because it's partly that they're bred to grow so incredibly fast, and partly that they have so little space to move. There's reason to think that they are suffering a great deal in the last weeks of their lives. So there's clear reasons to think about chicken if you're motivated to reduce meat consumption by animal welfare consideration.
So the next question is about digital sentience. You mentioned there was research on, you're doing some research about the relationship between learning abilities and sentience, and perhaps this might evoke some connection with, like, machine learning and reinforcement learning agents. Have you thought about the implications of your research for sentience in artificial agents?
Yeah, I have a bit. It's something that I don't rule out. And if I'm not ruling out any possible solution to the mind-body problem, then I can't rule out the idea that in the end, conscious experience depends on functional organization, and that a AI with the right kind of functional organization could have it. So I don't rule that out at all. I do think there are special challenges in trying to come up with good criteria for it. There's a certain kind of problem that you could think of as the gaming problem, that whenever you propose criteria for consciousness, when you propose them to animals, the animals don't know about the criteria. So you can think of yourself as genuinely trying to find markers of consciousness that will be stable through the course of the inquiry. With AI, well, the programmers potentially do know the criteria and can try to game them and to can try and produce shortcut mechanisms that will produce all and only those criteria you've come up with. And we see a phenomenon a bit like this with chatbots and the Turing test, where they're not passing the Turing test in any way, shape or form, really, in the sense it was intended. But for certain ways of evaluating how human they are, they can be made to game those criteria. And in the future, maybe there'll also be the further problem that the AI itself could know about the criteria and game them. And so that's a huge problem that adds an extra layer of difficulty to trying to come up with reasonable tests for conscious experience in AI.
Right, that's extremely interesting. Yeah, the point about how they might, in the future when they become advanced, they want to acquire more political and economic influence and just try to steer themselves to meeting everything that you just mentioned in the latest paper.
It's obviously a minefield, isn't it? Yeah.
That's super interesting. There's a question from the audience.
So thanks very much for your talk. That's much. So I want to ask a question about invertebrates, about how much we know about whether they feel pain, because I know there are some people who have written about the fact that they have stopped running forests because they fear the suffering that the bugs feel when you step on them when you're in forests, and therefore they only run on concrete. They also choose not to drive on highways because of all the bugs that might hit the windshield. Do you think this kind of behavior is in line with the precautionary principle, or is it taking it a bit too far?
It's not in line with the precautionary principle as I formulate it, because as I formulate it, it's a guide for policymakers, not for individuals. But then I suppose the real question is there some individual level analog of the precautionary principle that should guide our own conduct in relation to invertebrates? It's interesting. There's a paper by Knutson and Munther on this called A Virtue of Precaution. It's called something like that, that is arguing that as individuals, it's virtuous to err on the side of caution in our interactions with animals. I think, like any virtue, that's not something that should be taken to wild extremes, and there's obviously going to be situations in which refusing to drive a car or refusing to run through a forest would leave you rather compromised on other virtues if there are actually good reasons why you get into the car to go and help care for your elderly relative, or to go and work in a hospital or a school or something. So virtues, I think, should be displayed in moderation, including that one.
And then we have just on a final question. You mentioned at the start that sentience, the ability for valence phenomenal states is probably sufficient for moral status. Do you have any thoughts on sort of non-valenced phenomenal states? This Chalmers' idea of Vulcan, where they have these really deep and rich experiences, but they're not valence at all. Do you think the other
Peter Carruthers as well has talked about an example he calls phenom? Yeah, this idea of like a super Vulcan. I think the Vulcans in Star Trek do have emotions of some kinds. That they do have feelings. They're just very good at controlling them. But you can imagine a super Vulcan who genuinely has nothing. Nothing feels bad or feels good to them. Everything is completely flat, completely neutral. But nonetheless, there are conscious perceptions and thoughts going on. And then the question that's sometimes posed is, wouldn't that be sufficient for moral status? And I think there are other ways to get to moral status that don't run through sentience. So that's why I was reluctant to call it a necessary condition. I think there are other ways. And in particular, if you have conscious experiences and you're rational, I think that might be another way. So rather than phenomenal consciousness plus valence, phenomenal consciousness plus rationality, I think might be sufficient for moral status as well.
Okay, fantastic. This has been a really fascinating conversation, and we'll provide links for all our listeners to check out more of your work on animal sentience. But for now,
thanks.
Jonathan Birch, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's okay, thank you.